We'll be dealing with fairly rapidly rotating stars, so they end up squeezing themselves. Joke. We'll be quite often in various talks showing you what the entire surface looks like in Mulwady projection. So the equator is here, the two poles are here, but it has the advantage that one can see the structures. I'm helped by the ash mob. I used to belong to a convective collective, and that had the great advantages of protection. But the work that we'll be showing involves a number of us young colleagues, and I don't know who said that we are the ash mob. This is the name of a code, but we are. And there's a fair amount of representation of the ash mob, so if you wish to beat me up, we have at least defensive maneuvers. But Kyle Augustson has a poster that we'll be looking at, again using shells that rotate fairly fast, as does Ben Brown. Kyle has been looking at F stars, which are more massive stars than the Sun. Ben, on the other hand, rotates things very rapidly. Sasha does whatever Sasha does, all of astrophysics. Nick Featherstone tends to be an internal plumber on A-type stars. Mark Meesch is just a very wise soul who does a tremendous amount of work. And Nick Nelson is learning the craft by looking at also rapidly rotating stars. But it's a nice collegial relationship. And since these are fairly long-term investments in time, it's nice to have a group of colleagues working together. It boosts one's spirits. But some of the main issues that we're dealing with in very central to this entire Dynamo workshop is to try to understand how is it that any star, including our own Sun, can build fairly large-scale, reasonably orderly bands of choroidal magnetic field. At least that's what we think is the cause of much of the stuff that eventually erupts. Now, the difficulty is that it looks like the Sun seems to involve shear boundary layers. And boundary layers, they seem fairly docile, but they're in fact fairly subtle places, as Nick Brummel has told us this morning, that you wish them to do certain things, but they don't necessarily do what you would like to have them do. It may be that slightly more rapidly rotating stars have a much easier time of it. Perhaps they're able to avoid having to deal with particularly the tachocline kind of a boundary layer. They may still have it, but it may not be such a conspirator in the entire process by which the cycle operates. Helioseismology, of course, provides serious constraints on it, and it yielded results which were contrary to what our previous prejudice might have been before we did helioseismology. The primary one, we've known for a long time that there must be some sort of a near-surface shear layer, which is certainly confirmed in these angular velocity pictures, equator here, pole here. But the presence of a tachocline was certainly a surprise, total surprise. And that the radiative interior should be largely in solid body rotation was also another surprise, because one was pushing fairly seriously the idea that since we've been spinning down this star by the sending out a magnetized wind, that the interior could very well have been rotating 5 or 8 times faster than the current rate. And Bob Dickey was particularly pushing that fairly heavily, and he was a very interesting man. But the Sun doesn't seem to comply with that. And in a way, it may be easy to say, but we are certainly in a magnetic star, maybe not as fierce as some other ones, but we have fairly two subtle boundary layers. Now, the temptation would be to say that if it's a boundary layer, it's not so important. It only occupies a very small fraction of space. On aircraft, the boundary layer, you might have a 777 wing that goes on for 10 meters, but a boundary layer of about 1 or 2 millimeters takes you between being an aircraft and being a rock. And so it has subtleties there, it's quite evident. We don't know whether that is the case here. It may very well be that you actually have to get the tachocline sensibly right before you can get self-consistent models of how you support a tachocline. Most of our approaches so far have been reasonably benign. We think of some processes by which you could build a tachocline, but we don't know what the couplings really are. And we certainly would be very interested in being able to study its detailed structure and variability, but it has some problems. The acoustic modes that could probe that region tend to be fairly small in number. They tend to be things that get down to that point are of spherical harmonic degree about 20 or so. We go up to 4,000. But those are very extremely shallow, so the resolution that helioseismology can afford really shrinks very rapidly. And so there are many issues that we'd like to ask about the properties of this tachocline, but they're difficult to do because we tend to get fairly blurry inversions from that. The near surface shear layer is much more accessible to us, that occupies about the 5%. And it is certainly interesting because it is indeed, must be the home of many of the structures that we see, and we'll be looking at this with elegant sort of resolution with the Solar Dynamics Observatory in about half a year's time. But on the other hand, why is it present? What is its dynamical role? Many of these things are still to be asked also. So we have a star with two boundary layers, that makes it somewhat more fun for fluid dynamicists. Nick Brummel has told us that there are many elements to how the dynamo works. It isn't so in this cartoon sketch of the photosphere here, convection zone tremendously distorted because it wants to put emphasis on the tachocline. But there are many elements to how the solar dynamo operates. You might say, fine, I have a fair amount of churning that goes around in a rotating system. I have a lot of dynamo action that many of us have studied, Fausto among others, that produces lots of small-scale magnetic chaff, and we see much of it rising to the surface. But there is pumping, that Steve Tobias has particularly studied, that will, because you are compressible flows that are much faster downflows than upflows, you will pump a bunch of that magnetic chaff and other things down, possibly into the organizing structure of the tachocline, and it will comb fields out and possibly build the large toroidal fields, which eventually become unstable and some fraction of them erupt and make it through the surface, others get recycled. Well, there are many elements to what we might call a global dynamo, and they're not possibly not local. One of the questions is that we've arrived at this state believing that in the bulk of the convection zone, it's unlikely that we could build large organized structures and have them stay there, and that you have a better time of it if you could build it in this great organizing shear below the convection zone. But we might want to revisit that question, possibly. And it turns out that as we have started to play with some more rapidly rotating stars, we find, in fact, it's possible to build fairly strong fields in the bulk of the convection zone, contrary to what some of our prejudice might have been. And what keeps them down, we'll find out that it looks like magnetic pumping on many sites are able to maintain the structures embedded within this convection zone itself. Whether that's an answer for the sun, possibly not at all. But there are some interesting things that we're learning as we go along. The code that we refer to just as a workhorse is this anelastic spherical harmonic that Sasha showed you some things from, where we look at a full shell. We might be studying most of the convection zone. Perhaps we have or not have the region of tachocline included. Main concern is to try to deal with something that has a reasonably realistic solar mean stratification, so that across the shell that we can deal with, we may scrape away the near surface regions because the convection would be of much smaller scale than we can resolve. We might go 2 or 3% from the surface inwards. That's a big step already. But then capture a density contrast of maybe 100 or so across the shell. So you're looking at fairly compressible motions. On the other hand, we filter away the sound waves, even though we use them in helioseismology to probe structures, because we don't want to follow sound around. Sound is really fast, and the convection is fairly slow. Near the base of the convection zone, the speed of sound is 200 kilometers per second, whereas the convective velocity is 50 meters per second. And you don't really want to follow sound if you could avoid it. So thus the anelastic filtering. And in this work, at least, if you wish to establish, look at how the differential rotation might be established, you would be well served by trying to at least adopt some aspects of the global geometry in a rotating system. So that's the game, and that's ASH. You could do this with other codes. Our big challenge is, as we were sort of saying, is it isn't the computing cycles. People are building much larger machines with an embarrassment of how to actually use them. We will have some supercomputers that will have 1 million processors available within a couple of years. Right now, there are machines with 100,000, 200,000 processors. The big challenge is how to use those machines, particularly if you have global communications and other things that are required. And much of the fluid dynamics that we look at, if it has any of this filtering done to it, so there's a Poisson equation buried in there, tends to require some form of global communication. and the machines are not being built very well for that. However, there are cycles available. So when Jim said, well, look, we might have to march something forward for a million time steps in our shearing box. Well, there are many of those millions available if you could productively use them. So the name of the game in terms of computing cycles has improved drastically. So what can we learn from this? Well, just another view of the things that Sasha already showed us. If we look at the effectively the highest resolution, reasonably moderate, but solution that we currently have in a paper that published by Misha et al, of what is the type of resolution that we can get on a sphere with this type of a code going up to about spherical harmonic degree of about 700, it has convective structures like these. The downflows are dark in these blues near the surface of this convection zone. So it's a fairly rich system. It's evolving fairly rapidly, and we could look at what are the consequences of such dynamics. We might call these giant cells in the sun, which we don't really see at the surface, but we think that they must be present. Another view of the same thing in the Mulwady view, as a cosmologist, looks like this. And at first sight, it looks like, well, it's fairly well peppered with everything. But in fact, when you begin to get a trained eye, there's more structural alignment at these low latitudes, which are sensing Taylor-Proudhon type of constraints than elsewhere, more isotropic things at the top. And we can see this particularly in the where we chopped off the high things just for visibility, something near the top, something in the middle of a layer. Again, radial velocities, but it emphasizes that deeper down, there are structures that have some alignment at low latitudes, which they don't have near the top. These are systems, this is without magnetism, that really couple over very many density scale heights, contrary to any sort of mixing type of approaches. And they have some interesting consequences. If we zoomed in our patch to say, well, let's just see what it looks like, there's lots of vorticity present. This is something from the equator going up to about 50 degrees north. They're rich systems, and you would like to follow them. Now, the sun is probably much more complicated than that because we're not dealing with the granulation and supergranulation. We're looking at sort of what might be the giant cells. Now, the main messages that come across is that the apparent horizontal scale changes from near the surface, where we're 2% of the way into the sun, to 5% of the way into the sun, such that the scales seem to be larger. But what it's really doing is that you end up having downflow systems that extend all the way through. The downflows really penetrate very much probably through the entire convection zone. They have a coupling time that might be of the order of 10 days from the top to the bottom. The object rotates in something like 25 days. So the Rossby numbers are appropriately about a third or fifth. So they're rotationally considerably constrained, and they're fairly interesting. Now, it's likely that the sun has much more complicated structures. We don't know what happens if we went to, so these are with Reynolds numbers, if you calculate them, of the order of a few hundred on some of these reasonable scales. What is it with a Reynolds number where to be 10 to the 6? We don't know. But we're great extrapolators of behavior. But these are the things we can sort of resolve and study the evolution. Now, one of the things with these systems is that the things I was showing you is really a piece extracted out of the convection zone. And under typically these type of rotations, not as complex a solution as the previous one, if we insisted that we have a constant flux coming in at the bottom and maybe a constant temperature or entropy at the top or some mixture thereof, fairly bland conditions, you tend to have a fair amount of alignment of the, these are angular velocity contours with a rotation axis, even under the solar conditions. But if you have a tachocline, which we are not incorporating, as Sasha was showing at the base of this, the tachocline must have a dynamical balance, and it too is roughly probably in some thermal wind balance. And that would impose a fairly weak temperature gradient from sort of a relatively cool equatorial region to a slightly warmer pole. But out of the contrast is actually very small. Out of 2 million degrees, it's 5 or 7 or 8 Kelvin. But if you do that, it has interesting consequences. It can also rotate the angular velocity contours around. And you might say you have a knob for changing those contours as Matthias Rempel first sort of pointed out, and we then looked at it with these codes also. But it says that what you do in the bulk of the convection zone probably is fairly sensitive to what happens in the dynamics of this little boundary layer, including its thermal balance. Now, it isn't that this is somebody just imposes it for you. You have a coupled system with fairly complicated sort of constraints operating. So it's an interesting subject. Sasha also visited the question of what happens if we took just one of these shells and turned magnetism loose and at least allowed it to generate fields. This is without penetration. And he said that one obtained fairly complicated features in these more weighty views. If we look at near the top of the radial velocity, radial magnetic field, the azimuthal magnetic field, there's a fair amount of concentration of the strong magnetism on the downflow systems. The problem with these solutions, I mean, they're interesting. The field strengths are of the order of 3,000 Gauss or so, credible enough, not a milligauss, not a macro Gauss, 3,000. But they're mostly in small-scale fluctuating fields rather than big organized structures. So it doesn't seem to be a toroidal field builder. If we look at a mouse, the mice sometimes get lost. If we look at some time evolution of that, of the radial velocity field, it sort of looks like a marching army, which is really what the convective cells are also doing. The strong magnetic fields that tend to be built on the downflow lanes. If, on the other hand, we take a snapshot, as Sasha was showing with maybe more lights on, of just one instant and just sort of peeling it around, this is the azimuthal magnetic field as we look into it. Well, it looks like it has something that looks like a toroidal structure, but has a lot of weaving in it. And the wreath-like structure comes about just from the fact that we've looked at the near equatorial region with some volume rendering. But the main problem is that we're getting the wrong types of fields. They're interesting fields. They have 3,000 Gauss strengths, but they're not building us strong, organized structures. And so on. Now, another variant of that would say, well, look, in Nick's picture, the cartoon of how the sun might operate, you want to be able to pump the fields into the organizing shear. So let us put a tachocline near the base of this. So we allow the convection to penetrate into a stable region, and the differential rotation that the convection itself establishes also imprints itself into that stable region. But then we kill off that shear below a certain depth by a body force that turns us into solid body rotation. So it's a home-built tachocline, inconsistent dynamics, but it has shear. And if we do that and operate the dynamo again under those circumstances, well, in the bulk of the convection zone, it is a little bit like the other one, a fair amount of, if we look at the azimuthal magnetic field, fairly complicated structure, 5,000 Gauss or so, typical field strengths. But in the base of the convection zone, below the convection zone, the tachocline, indeed, there's a fair amount of sort of organization with some noticeable one or other sense of toroidal field structure emerging. So it looks like the combing is working. In fact, if we looked at cross-section cuts of this, the angular velocity that's maintained in this system looks like this. It isn't as glorious as maybe the sun really is, but you can see that we have a home-built tachocline by a certain body force, so there's a fairly shearing structure. But if we wait long enough, this has a tendency to build itself fields of one sense in the northern hemisphere and another sense in the southern hemisphere. And there, the field strengths are of the order of 8,000, 10,000 Gauss. And if you let it run for a fairly long time, it sort of roughly maintains that or may flip. If we look at another rendering of the same thing of what the magnetic fields look like in the middle of the convection zone versus in the overshoot tachocline region, you see the combing tendencies. So those elements, and these are at least self-consistent in the sense that we pump, we amplify, we organize toroidal fields without actually putting it in. So it's capturing some of the elements in a reasonable way. And if we did any volume rendering of this thing just in that tachocline, again, the structures are fairly woven, but a particular sense is largely prevailing in the northern hemisphere and it's different in the southern hemisphere. And if we asked, well, what, how does the integrated dipole vary in that system over something of the order of 8,000 days? Then if we look in the Tachocline region, it almost wishes to flip, but doesn't quite in these things. Whereas closer to the surface, it's wobbling all over the place. So it has some elements of that might be the sun, but again, still reasonably far removed. Something that Ben Brown has started to pursue, and also Sasha with his young colleague, said, well, look, let's go to something like a younger sun, anything that just rotates faster. Here it really is the same model, 30% in depth, and let's rotate it five times faster. What do you get? Well, the angular velocities will be much more organized. They'll have that stronger tendency for Taylor-Proudman, a fairly big contrast in angular velocity from a fast equator to a slow pole. But the surprises have largely been that if you run this thing, it turns out that the low latitude convection tends to be very patchy, such that there really are almost solitons of behavior that sort of march their way around. Now this is the non-MHD sun. If you do the MHD version, now this is more interesting in a way, because it ends up building these sort of toroidal belts. This is the latitudinal, sort of longitudinal field, and has field strengths of about 10,000 Gauss, but it builds them of two senses in the two hemispheres, and these are in the bulk of the convection zone. It's building big toroidal bands. And Ben has gotten fairly good at this, and as he slows down the rotation rate, he can get this behavior to extend. This is rotating at five times the solar rate, down to about 1.5 solar rate. So maybe, even the sun may be doing something like this. We tend to be running fairly diffusive systems. Perhaps it will survive under those circumstances too. And he'll be happy to talk to you over a glass of wine and a poster. And if you ask, well, what is it doing? Well, it's largely trading off some of its as a function of time. And here, the time steps are typically 200 seconds, and he's done this for about 8,000 days. So it's a fairly long computations. But the machines are there that can do it. So they're really thinking, they're Gedanken experiments. And we have trade-offs basically between the magnetic energy waxing and waning, and doing so against a differential rotation, while the convective energy is fairly steady. So they're interesting dynamical systems, and they have the advantage that they build interesting sort of wreaths with multiple senses in the two hemispheres as we look at volume rendering. I mean, this is eye candy, but it's also a way of trying to understand what's happening with these structures. And they hold themselves in place because magnetic pumping, we believe, is holding that region a fairly strong magnetic field from just rising to the top of the layer. They tend to be near the base. But if you look at the magnetic field structures, they're not monolithic tubes everywhere. They're in fact very ragged toroidal structures. Field comes in, field goes out. And the final thing is, it's not just these stars. If you go to more massive stars like F-type stars, which are about 1.3 times the solar rate and 10 times, in this case, rotation rate that Kyle Augustin has been looking at very recently, and its magnetic field, it again builds bands in the bulk of this very thin convection shell. This looks like a racing bicycle, for its convection was only 11% thick, whereas the sun is 33% mountain bike. So bands are present, but we have much to learn about them. This is just still early stages. So where are we? Well, it's certainly one message from the last few years is that more rapid rotation helps build toroidal belts. Whether that contributes to the solar problem isn't clear. It possibly you might say no tachocline is needed, but these stars still may have a tachocline. We haven't looked at the consequences of that. We have the joy of looking at some of the elements of the solar dynamo. Maybe they're becoming more realizable, but Fausto was telling me this morning over coffee, the more we try, the less we know. And that may be the worse it gets. But then he's a man in Chicago. He's supposed to be a very enthusiastic Italian who's ebullient, but what do you do when he says the worse it gets? On the other hand, these Gedanken tools will keep improving. And the question is, can we figure out how to have codes or problems that are well enough posed where we could use these as essentially the laboratory tools for exploring some of this? Thank you very much.
questions. Very interesting presentation. Do you know where why the toroidal flux tubes are so close to the equator? Some people always thought it should actually arise along the rotation axis when you have rapid rotation. You don't seem to see that at all.
Well, some of the challenges here are that if you go to fairly rapidly rotating ones and ask where are your shear layers, in the things that of solar geometry, they're at around 20 degrees latitude. And they're concentrated where the maximum radial shear, or at least the shear across the Taylor columns, is maximized. And as you go to F stars, where the shells are much thinner, that intersection cylinder is also closer to the equator. It's probably that largely.
Yes. You showed us a lot of instantaneous shots. But
we showed what?
A lot of instantaneous shots, pictures.
Yes.
But never mean average pictures. And I was wondering what it would look like. And because, you know, as you increase Reynolds number, you put more and more fluctuation, and any mean, any average flow will be lost. And so is that just because the average magnetic field is zero, or why you never show?
The ones with faster rotation have the poloidal toroidal components are getting to be, the mean ones are getting to be significant. Whereas in the under the solar conditions, they're really very minor players. So some of the estimates here of what is the mean toroidal magnetic energy, mean poloidal energy, they're getting to be something of the order of 20%. This is the total magnetic energy, and this is the mean toroidal energy. So they're already fairly significant compared to the things that were not rotating so fast. I don't have any pictures here. I can show you that later.
Are you anywhere near, or maybe you already do it, of calculating or predicting the frequencies that you see in helioseismology? It would seem to me to be a lot easier thing to do the forward problem and calculate the frequencies from these models than to try to do the inversions.
Oh, well, we have done some work in asking, could we see some of these large-scale structures seismically, helioseismically, and they're promising. And we're partly looking at those with local helioseismology at depths of about 10 megameters. I mean, but most of the differential rotation profiles and so on, those are really accessible with the global modes.
Yeah, my question was whether you can actually see the solar.
Well, I think they would be most likely. One question is, can you separate out unambiguously what would be the magnetic signature from what would be a thermal signature, thermal fluctuation? And that gets to be very hard, because the field strengths would have to be, technically it can be done, but can we deduce that from the helioseismic observations? And that's tough, because the magnetic pressure is still a very small fraction of the gas pressure.
Yuri, in your simulation, which has the Tacker Cline, you have a lot of fluctuations in the convection zone, and you have a large-scale field in the Tacker Cline.
Yes.
So if it pumps fluctuations into the Tacker Cline, how does it not stretch all fluctuations? Well, how does it choose one sign of fluctuations to stretch preferential to the other one? What's the mechanism for that?
Well, we don't know why it is that we've gotten one sense in one hemisphere, one sense in the other. I mean, that must be some residue of essentially some poloidal field that has also pumped in with all the fluctuations. So there must be a fair amount of reconnection occurring in this region. And of course, we're running reasonably diffusive systems that by diffusion itself will be accomplishing that, cleaning up the high scale fields. There are a fair amount of fluctuations in that Tacker Cline, but there's still a prevailing tendency. So, yeah, I mean, you would stretch everybody, but why does something still emerge with a certain sense?
Okay, thanks, Yuri, again.
finally, before tea, we have Nick Featherston.